Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Voices from the Archives. I'm Maurice O'Keefe. This week's podcast is an interview with Dan Christopher Somerville. Drishan House in Castle Townsend in West Cork is the home of the Somervilles. I visited there in 2010 to meet Tom Somerville while I was working on an oral history project to do with the Great Houses of Ireland. Tom suggested to me that I should maybe meet his father because at the time he was still living in Shellingford in Devon. I called there and that indeed was a memorable occasion. We sat down to talk and my first question was how far back he could trace his family.
Well, I have to count back. I think it must be 8 or 9. The first Somerville to come over and exchange Scotland for Ireland was a man who started life as a lawyer. And then when Cromwell and his lot disappeared and the king came back to England, he saw that the glebe lands that belonged originally to the Church of Scotland would be coming back on the market again. And so he hastily read for holy orders. He got them in a year and was inducted into the parish of Leswalt, which is quite close to Ireland, at Stranraer. Mm. And they didn't like the people who had the glebe land and farmed it, didn't like the idea at all. And they attacked his surveyors who were surveying the glebe land for him, and they drove them off, cutting their ropes and things. However, he hadn't been a lawyer for nothing. He got the Privy Council to send them back with a posse of soldiers, and this time he had no trouble. He got in, he got his glebe land, and he lived there from the early 1660s until 1688. But unfortunately, in 1688, Black William came to the throne, and his parishioners sent a message to him to say they were coming to burn him out. And he and his family had to get on horseback and clatter down into Stranraer and look for a boat to take them to Ireland, where he had a cousin in Larne on the other side of the water. The only boat they could find was an open boat. I don't know what time of day or night it was, but whatever, they piled into it. He and his wife and his son-in-law and daughter his son-in-law and daughter and my direct ancestor, the first of the Toms, and who was 1 year old at the time, and they rowed across the straits, and they did, in fact, end up at Larne, and that was their arrival in Ireland.
This is still a long way from the southwest of Ireland.
Oh, indeed, yeah. It is. The old man, the writer to the Signet, and the chap who was put out of his benefice, he didn't last very long. He died, they say, a disappointed man somewhere on the shores of Loch Ness. And anybody who knows Northern Ireland knows that Loch Ness is not the place for a disappointed man to spend very long. But his son, there must have been money, I think, brought over at the same time, because his son, my immediate ancestor, the first Thomas, was able to go to Trinity and read theology and in due course get himself inducted into the Church of Ireland and got the living of Castle Townsend right down in the south, or Castle Haven, I should say, as it was then. Mm-hmm. And he lived in the old church, in the what is now a ruin next door to the old church, which is also now a ruin too, in Castle Haven.
And it's also connected to Dean Swift. I mean, it has a connection with the.
Oh yes, the dean did in fact stay the night with my ancestor, and. His spirit, my ancestor's spirit, was conjured up by my great aunt at a séance, and he was supposed to have said to her that the dean had a bark like an ill-tempered dog, but he was as honest as God's angels, and it meant a lot to him that he'd had the dean for a night.
Drishan, when was it first built?
Well, it was, I think, the old part of the house, which was quite small, started life as a corn store, so they say. I rather doubt this myself. It sounds like as though it had been a small house. Mm. But the eldest son of my immediate ancestor, Thomas II, we can call him, if you like, he was destined for the church as well, but he lost an eye. And in those days, you had to be presented to the Lord as a complete, unblemished sacrifice, not only in mind, but also in body. So that the fact that he'd lost an eye meant that he couldn't become a clergyman. And so he went into business, and he started running ships from Castlehaven to the Caribbean and to Newfoundland. And he made a very good thing out of it. And I have seen in the Hibernian of the day in the 1770s an advertisement for the good ship so-and-so, 280 tons burden, will be sailing 6 months from now from Castlehaven, and there will be a coastal ship calling in at all the ports from Cork down west to bring people into Castlehaven where they can join this ship.
So he was very much a merchant.
He was very much a merchant. He was known as Tom the Merchant. And he had the money to buy land, first of all, about the best part of 1,000 acres originally he bought along the seaboard westwards. Mm-hmm. And
taking in Whitehall and all those places?
All those places, yes. Mm-hmm. He also bought... Drishan, that's the small house as it was then, and he added on the big square block, which you can see in the photograph.
Yes.
And we don't think he employed an architect. The plan of it is simple, but the use of space is wasteful. There are really only 6 double bedrooms in the main house, and it looks as though it could have taken 8 or 10.
Well, there's a fine entrance hall.
Yes, there's the entrance hall, which originally was the counting house, because the old man who built the house wanted to keep the business going. Mm-hmm. And so what is now the hall was originally the counting house. Mm-hmm. And then to the left of it was a dining room, and then next door to that was the original front, is the original front hall, which has been closed off and is now used as a library. Mm-hmm. And then southward again is the drawing room, into which children were only allowed on sufferance and seldom. And next door to that is a place always known as the library and was originally, I think, designed as a library. When I was a boy, they ran a sort of lending library to people in the village who wanted to come and borrow books.
Very interesting, yes, indeed. They gave out books locally.
They gave out locally, books to local people.
Coming on then to the next generation.
And Thomas III, the original idea, I imagine, of Thomas II, his father, was that his son could get out of trade and live the life of a gentleman. Justice of the peace and all that. And that's why he bought all the land, which was let out to tenants.
Yeah.
And the tenants provided the income to keep the house going.
I see.
So that the man at the top didn't have to do any work. And he was a magistrate, I think, and that kind of thing. That was all right, you see. But unfortunately, he did two bad things, because he had no business experience. He went and backed a bill for a friend who subsequently ratted on him and disappeared.
Really?
And he then contracted jail fever, that is typhus, as a result of being a magistrate. He must have caught it from one of the prisoners.
My.
And he died, and his widow, his unfortunate widow, was pregnant with, I think, her 11th child,
yeah.
And in no sort of state to look after affairs. So matters were taken in hand by one of his brothers, who was living in Skull, mm-hmm. in a house called the Prairie, and I don't think he behaved well.
But, in what way now?
Well, they sold land, mm-hmm. In order to finance things, because the eldest son was not, you know, hadn't attained his majority or anything like that. And they sold land when they had no need to. And also they sold belongings out of the house. They sold the dining room chairs. I know this for certain because I know who ended up buying them. That was the wife of Mrs. Bernard Shaw. And we, Celia and I, have seen those chairs in Shaw's Corner.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Mrs. Bernard Shaw was a cousin.
Mrs. Bernard Shaw was a cousin, in fact. Yeah. And indeed, when my great-aunt, finding that these chairs were coming up at auction, decided to go off and buy them, Mrs. Bernard Shaw, who was staying as a cousin in the house, said, "Oh, well, I'll come to the auction with you." Having much more money than my great-aunt, she outbid her for the chairs.
That was Edith Somerville.
Yes.
My goodness, yeah. Isn't that interesting? Did Edith Somerville live long enough for you to know her?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. And sure. Even I knew her, met her.
Oh, did you?
Yes. Yes, and she made great friends with my mother, who painted and liked all the things she liked, and said when she went to heaven, she was going to spend the entire time painting.
So she loved painting. How would you describe her yourself, Dan? Describe Edith for me.
Well, as I knew her, when I knew her, I was not in the least terrified of her. She was just you could treat her in some ways as a contemporary. Mm. She had a sort of contemporary view of some things, but on the other hand, at the age of nearly 90, when she was just short of her 90th birthday when she died, she was also a child of her time. Mm. And she was really very nice to us. She saw us as the sort of end generation, the latest generations that she would see.
She was sweet, yeah.
And she was very easy and good with us. But the generation before me, that's to say my mother's generation, not including my mother, who had plenty of spirit of her own, were frightened of her. They thought of her as a, you know, as somebody with a violent temper and a bit of a tartar.
Really?
But
this was very. This was the time that children were only meant to be seen, not heard.
But our generation was not like that.
Mm. You played backgammon.
We played backgammon with her. She used to cheat at backgammon.
Did you see her at work painting?
No. I've seen her come in from painting out of doors with a freshly done oil painting.
Really?
Yeah. Which the family admired tremendously. I didn't think myself it was all that good. But this was the difficulty with her generation particularly, that everything that she did was admired uncritically.
Was it? Indeed,
yes.
Yeah.
She lacked helpful criticism.
Mm-hmm.
She had three exhibitions in London, put on by an admirer of hers in London, someone called Mrs. Anstey. And I believe they were quite successful. I think it was the Goupil Gallery that put them on. I think they were quite successful. But money was always easy come, easy go with her. She was an immensely generous woman.
Was she? Yes. So money wasn't important
money
to her.
Money wasn't important
to her. But
she
had her hands, didn't she?
You couldn't really... I mean, it was cheaper to run a pack of hounds in the 1910s and 20s than it became later.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still quite expensive. And there were never enough subscribers to cover the cost.
And who was living in the house at that stage?
The house was owned by my Uncle Cameron, who was abroad a lot of his time as a soldier. She used to write long letters to him, but effectively she was running the place herself.
Mm-hmm.
She ran it, really, I suppose, for the best part of 50 and 60 years.
But she would have had plenty of domestic staff.
Plenty of help.
Mm-hmm.
There was never any trouble about that. She was living, between the wars, she was living permanently with my great aunt Hildegard, her sister, who paid her share. They both contributed together. She had married Edgerton Coghill, into the Coghill family she'd married, but he died in 1919.
Mm-hmm.
And after he died, she came up to live at Drashawn with her sister. And then in 1921, my great uncle Cameron retired from his job as Kneller Hall, where the English bands are trained.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a bachelor, he never married. So he came to live with them.
Yeah.
And that was the three of them, then lived there together all the time between the wars, up in fact to 1942 when my great uncle Cameron died.
You have a very nice room set out in Drashawn with all the letters and memorabilia from her own archive.
Yes, we wanted to do this partly because it made a good use of her studio, which had been used previously as a sort of junk room where you put things that you didn't want to throw away but you didn't actually need.
Yeah.
and the room became chaotic. It always was in my parents' time, a chaotic room. We were able to get old display cases from the Bodleian Library. They didn't need them anymore. And we bought ourselves a trailer over here, and a second-hand trailer. We loaded these exhibition cases, which are excellent, although they are either Edwardian or late Victorian, but that suits the house. And we brought them over to Ireland. And we couldn't get them in through the door. We had to take out a window in order to get them all in. But that's where they are.
Your father's Desmond. He was in the First World War.
Oh, he was.
Yes, very much so.
The family took to going into the South Wales Borderers. And
why was that, do you know?
Well, nobody quite knows, but I think Neville Coghill in the 1870s won the VC at Isandlwana in the Zulu War. And he was the first to go into the South Wales Borderers, which was, of course, terribly badly cut up at Isandlwana.
Yeah.
After that, my father went into it. I think that quite a lot of both my father's generation and my grandfather's generation went into the services because it offered plenty of sport and plenty of outdoor life and a lot of comradeship. A famous fox hunting character said, it's the sport of kings, the image of war without its guilt and only 5% and 20% of its danger. And I think that's how they regarded it.
Where was your father fighting?
Well, he had really no fighting to do until the First World War started.
Yeah.
But when that started, he was abroad. His regiment was abroad. They came back as far as Suez in Egypt, and there they became part of the expeditionary force that was going to Gallipoli. And he was in the landing at Gallipoli. The Turks, of course, knew that something was coming, undoubtedly, because very little attempt was made to conceal it. And my father and his men were put into a whaler commanded by a 16-year-old midshipman. And
completely inexperienced.
Completely inexperienced. Nobody had done anything like this before. And they rowed in this whaling boat. Fortunately, they made an unopposed landing and were able to get up a place so steep that the Turks hadn't bothered to fortify it. And they got above the Turks and they shot at them. But the men were so excited, my father said they couldn't hit anything.
So he survived that. But, I mean, that was yes. That battle at Gallipoli was an awful lot of soldiers died in that.
Oh, a great many. My father was very lucky not to be killed at the landing.
Yeah. So did he tell you all this? Did he?
Yes, he did.
Yeah, and how did they get away from there then?
They did a very careful deception plan. They put up dummies in the trenches here and there, and the Turks seemed to have thought that the trenches were still fully manned, and they weren't. And they were allowed to They were allowed to filter away gradually. They didn't lose a man getting out. They lost plenty going in. Yes, well, he was wounded.
Oh, was
actually,
he?
Yes, he was wounded in the follow-up attack. All the men were stretched out across the peninsula in a line, and nobody was allowed to get ahead of anybody else. These days, of course, you would that's the first thing you'd want to do, some party, to try to get in behind where the enemy were and shoot them up from behind. But no, they had to go up like a line of beaters after grouse. And nobody was allowed to get ahead of anybody else. And he was shot in the leg.
Was he badly wounded?
He was shot in the leg. He was sent off back to Malta to recover. And he was able to get back to Gallipoli. For a second time, yes. And rejoin the regiment, which I think means that probably he didn't take more than 2 or 3 months to recover. So it can't have been all that bad.
He spent so many years in service away in the army. And when he returned back to Castle Townsend, it must have been very quiet for him and very different.
Yes. My mother said, "I can't think what your father will do with himself when he retires." But she needn't have worried. He turned himself into a farmer. He took what land was left in hand and farmed it himself. And he was a very good farmer. But the trouble was that he had no idea that if you've only got 33 acres of arable and 100 acres of rough woodland, and you employ two men, and you employ two horses as well, and you don't have a tractor, that you cannot make any money.
Yeah.
And, but he enjoyed doing it.
Yeah.
It was, he went to, he and his cousin, Patrick Coghill, who also had land, they went into partnership together. And the first draft, the first money, the first profit in the deed that was drafted between them, the first £200 was to be an honorarium for the working partner. I don't know how often he managed to collect that £200, but I don't suppose it was very often.
So did all of this affect him later on in his life? I mean, was he, as many of the First World War soldiers, were shell-shocked? Did it affect him?
No, not
it didn't
a bit.
Seem to, no, no, I think so. You see, both Celia's father and mine were professional soldiers. They engaged as professional soldiers. This is one of the things that happen if you're a professional.
And so was he a very strict, disciplined type of character?
He was disciplined, but not unduly so.
No, he was terribly nice.
A creature of habit, I'd say.
Yes.
To some extent,
He was great, actually.
Mm. But I think he found it difficult to make the transition between somebody that you ordered about for their own good and somebody who made decisions for themselves but could turn into a companion.
Yes.
He and I made a long trip by car together out from England to Turkey, where we were working at the time.
What were you doing?
I was working for the British Council in Turkey.
Mm.
And we were there, and we drove from London to Istanbul all the way. It took us a fortnight.
Yeah.
And during that time, we were able to rough it, which he enjoyed doing.
Yeah.
My mother didn't really like roughing things. And he liked that. We got talking as two individuals together, and I think it did him a lot of good. And they said when he got back to Castle Townsend that he looked 10 years younger.
Were you determined, as was your father, to the upkeep of Dushan and to have it as your home?
My father said to me, you know, see if you can make anything of it, and if you can't, you'll have to sell up. And I took it on that basis. Had it been really necessary to sell, we would have done so, because I mean, much as one loves these places, places that one has spent time in as a child and as a boy, I always think that people are more important than places in the long run. And if somewhere is no longer possible for people to live a good life in, then they should go. But luckily, it never came to that.
Was there any sense of responsibility towards the upkeep and the management of your ancestors' place? Now, I know you told me that people are more important than place.
Yes.
But was there a sense of place?
Very much a sense of place. I think so. When people who are now dead, but whom you knew, lived in the house, something of their presence you can feel when you go there yourself. And although I've never seen, none of us have ever seen or even felt a ghost there, other people have done so and have told me, I've been told that people in the village will think twice before they come up the avenue at night.
But at the same time, I mean, there was a feeling that, you know, with the portraits on the walls and your ancestors looking down on you,
yeah.
I mean, that was the a reminder of the generations before you.
Yes.
So you were there in the 80s and 90s, and you were spending more time there. I suppose the next generation, Tom, he took a great interest in,
yes.
in Drishan. And,
oh, yes, and, he did. And it's lovely to see that he did, and that he's married someone who is fitting in there. Although it's not the life that she ever expected for herself, I think.
Mm.
But she is sort of fitting in there and becoming part of the place.
I must say, coming here today and sitting down in your company and talking to you has been wonderful. And so, Dan, thank you so much for your time. Thank you.
Not at all. It's been a pleasure.
We've come to the end of this week's podcast with Dan Christopher Somerville. I hope you enjoyed listening to him, and if you would like to hear his full interview, it's available on irishlifeandlore.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.